Welcome back to Sunday Civics, the show where we engage, educate, and encourage you to take civic action. I'm your host, L. Joy Williams, that is. And today we're excited to welcome a very special guest who's been at the front of the class before, but it's been a while and now she's on a whole nother coast. Kat Calvin, an extraordinary activist, thinker, and the author of American Identity in Crisis, Notes from an Accidental Advocate. And you see all my notes here, all my notes. I'm going to be breaking them out, Kat. She's been at the forefront of pivotal movements, using her voice and platform to address key issues in today's society. She describes herself as an accidental activist, and she has navigated the complexities of modern social movements, shining a light on the intersections of race, identity, and politics in America. Her book, which we're going to talk about extensively, takes a look at these dynamics, providing thoughtful commentary on the state of America and the evolving nature of activism and how people, you know, get active. So, Kate, welcome back to the front of the class. Hello.
Hello. I'm so happy to be back. Thank you.
Thank you for saying yes and coming back to the front of the class in this new year. Your first guest of the new year. Yay.
Oh my gosh. Amazing. What better way to start the year?
So as I told you, you know, I like to read books before, you know, I talk about them. You can tell the difference when you have it. And I know since you've been on book tour, you're just be like, that's not, I don't have no chapter about yep. that at all, but I'm going to just try to answer yes. this little question that you done came with up with on your index card.
It's like right. you were there. Yep.
It is very hilarious to me, but like I do it like a game when I watch authors doing their book tours and I'm like, they ain't read that book. Because
you get you always know.
And as I'm like started the process of writing my own, I'm like looking forward Yay. To it because I'm like, I want to talk. I haven't have a publicist yet, but when I get a publicist, I'm going to have to talk to them and be like, okay, so I want to make it a thing of calling out people for not reading the book. How do we? I know. I'm just like, I know you haven't read the book, but let me tell you how, like what you just asked connects to what I actually did write. Okay, moving on.
Oh, please let me witness that live and in person.
So Kat, I'm going to ask the general question on what inspired you to write it in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for being one of the few who read it. I have been doing ID work. And for folks who don't know, I run an organization that helps people get photo ID across the country. And there are 26 million American adults who don't have photo ID and nobody knows it. And we've been, you know, shouting from the rooftops for years as we do this work. And I just sort of got to a point where I thought, you know, writing a book may be a way to help get this message out to more. You know, we have a bill in Congress that would get IDs for every American. We're trying so hard to solve this problem, but we need a movement. We need the American people to be behind us. And I thought, you know, a book. Also, who doesn't want to write a book? I love books. I have too many books. My grandmother was a librarian. I grew up in House of the Book. So like having my own is also just an amazing thing. But particularly, you know, for the goals of this movement, my hope is, you know, it's short, it's funny, it's pink. I'm really hoping that people will read it and care enough about the issue to get involved.
So one of the aspects I like about the book is at the end of each chapter is takeaways, which we love doing here on Sunday Civics as well. You know, so yes, it tells a narrative, tells a story, some of them funny, you know, as you go through. And then at the end, it's sort of wrapping it all up for you and sort of giving you, force feeding you what the takeaway should be if you read this book. And I found that particularly interesting and helpful as we are struggling with people not reading. They don't even read a whole social media post sometimes to get like full context, right? Yeah. And so to be able to provide that. So I'm actually highlighted, some of the highlights here I have are some of those takeaways. And one of the ones from the beginning is that the United States is the only country with an ID crisis. Talk a bit more about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it is a distinctly American problem. Almost every other country on earth, every other developed country, people, you know, get IDs. It's not an issue. They're free or they're very inexpensive. The document requirements are not burdensome. You just go when you turn 15, 16, whatever the age is, to your local government office and you get an ID. And if you lose it, you get it replaced. This is not an issue anywhere else. It's actually hilarious when I talk to people from other countries, especially Germans. Germans do not understand this because their government is so efficient. And Germans always love asking about this. Like, I don't understand. Like, they don't understand voter registration because you're just registered to, like, you don't have to, like, do a thing. The government just knows where you are. They register you. And they're like, explain to me again how voter registration works. And it's so funny. And when I talk about the fact that we have 11% of adults in this country who don't have ID, so they can't get jobs or housing or whatever, it blows people's minds from other countries because it's just not an issue. Everywhere else, we make sure that, or they make sure their citizens have IDs. Yeah.
And particularly because as a foster parent, I have witnessed, and something you highlight in the book in terms of foster children themselves, when they come out of care, mm-hmm. them having original documents, having items, and also the bureaucracy that sometimes is in the way, and also the overburdened workers who don't have the capacity to help and assist. And I remember getting so frustrated a couple of months ago where one gentleman, you know, I'd witnessed going to the foster care agency for visits with one of my children, and hearing this dad who had come for visits, he comes the same time as I do, asking, you know, so-and-so said I can get a job with him, but I need to get my ID and I don't have a birth certificate. Like, and he was asking like visit after visit after visit, right? And then I'm like, he can just go on the web, like he could do it from his phone and get his birth certificate. So he can go and get the ID. And I got so frustrated that he was coming week after week and asking the same question. I was like, come to my office after this visit. And I literally walked him through the process. He put in his information and I paid the fee. Like, cause I was like, I'm tired. You asking the same question and people not able to help you when you're trying to get this job. Cause you need your birth certificate to get ID in order to get this job. And that is the domino effect that people aren't realizing that people are living through. Isn't it, Kat?
It is. And, you know, it's so key that you say that he was going to the agency and they couldn't help him. The number of organizations and government agencies and elected officials who send people to us, you know, social workers aren't trained to get documents. And even if they know how, they don't have the funds for it. Case managers don't have the funds. None of these people, you know, we've got literal like government agencies whose job is to work with the unhoused who send people to us because they can't get documents. And people don't realize that there really isn't a lot of places that people can go where they can actually be assisted, especially if their situations are complicated. If you're a foster youth, it always is. You don't always have, you know, your mom's name and maiden name and your dad's name and where you were born and your social security number and all the things you have to have and then the $10 to $90, et cetera. And it can be really complicated. And so we get so many clients who do not run into someone amazing like you, but who have been trying for months, for years, sometimes for decades to get a birth certificate. And you know, if you go to Vital Records and ask for a birth certificate, they'll ask for your ID. But to get an ID, you need a birth certificate. And it's just wildly complicated. One of our general counsel actually got a message from a woman who was in Florida and this was just last week, had been trying so hard, had been going to every agency. No one had been able to help her get a birth certificate. And our GC called, you know, the Vital Records, et cetera. And they were like, oh, well, you're a lawyer. You can just order one. And sometimes, you know, it helps that she and I are lawyers because literally there's often a separate way for lawyers. And so we're able to get a birth certificate that other people can't get. But a lot of people don't have access to attorneys or attorneys who know how to do that. It's so complicated. Every county has different rules. Every state has different rules. And you then end up with people who are completely trapped. You know, you need a birth certificate to get Section 8 housing, right? And an ID, all these things. And, you know, we are not providing the access, the training, the funds that people need to get it. And that's how you end up with a number like 26 million.
Now, I want to step back a second because, as you state, like, you know, most people believe it's easy, right? Oh, you know, but if you think back, where did you, if you just take a moment to think, who did you get your birth certificate from? Right? I didn't get my birth certificate from my mom. And I know who my mom is. I lived with her, like went from, you know, high school to college with her and then eventually living out life and was like, oh, I need a copy and asked my mom, you have my birth certificate? Oh, it's somewhere, right? And ended up having to, you know, find out how to get a copy of it myself. I wasn't born, you know, in New York. Although I was raised in New York, I was born in Kansas because my father was in the military at the time. And so, like, how do I get a copy of it in Kansas? Like, figuring all of that out. Yep. For most people, oh, my mom has it, my dad has it, or my grandparents have it. I can just go to their house and get it if I'm lucky. And then going through the process of getting ID. Maybe you were taken and gotten your, you know, permit when you were 16. And so, like, that begins the process of your ID. But as you mentioned, there are millions that are living life in this country without it. And it's gotten increasingly more difficult to get identification. And you highlight this in one of the takeaways, that the ID crisis started after September 11th.
Yeah, the numbers is, you know, that there have always been a population of folks in this country who didn't have IDs, but it was at a much smaller number. And then what happened is during 9/11, the 19 terrorists had some like 36 IDs that they had gotten around the country relatively legally. You know, for those of us who are old enough and remember what it was like getting an ID before 9/11, if you had a valid ID or driver's license from another state and you went to a new state to leave, they would give you one. You didn't need a huge stack of documents. You didn't need all of these proofs of residency, et cetera. It was pretty easy. Well, that was misused. And so one of the reactions to that was the 9/11 Commission creating Real ID, which, as we know, has still not fully been implemented, probably never will be. But while that was happening, all 50 states in the district very quietly changed the rules and made it really difficult. So what most people don't realize is that in most states, there's just a person who decides what's required in order to get an ID. It's, you know, the Secretary of Transportation or the mayor of DC, right, or whoever it is. It's not statutory in most states. And so a person or a committee can just decide. And so they didn't have to seek congressional approval. They didn't have to get a ballot measure right or anything. They just said, you know what, we're just going to make this harder. And so all of a sudden the rules changed. They got much more difficult. And so then you had all of these people who were able to get IDs before who can't now. So, you know, one of the reasons that we started seeing a lot of seniors not be able to vote after voter ID laws passed is because they'd always had an ID. But then these new rules passed and then they couldn't get one because we have a lot of seniors who never got birth certificates. Either they were born, you know, at home or in rural areas, or if you were Black and you were in a Jim Crow town and you weren't getting a birth certificate. Like, there were so many people who never got a birth certificate. And that was fine for a long time. You could still get an ID. But then, you know, if you're a senior and you let it lapse because you don't drive anymore or whatever else, then all of a sudden they need an ID to vote. And then they went to the DMV and they're like, oh, well, you can't now. Because now there's all these new rules and requirements and you never had a birth certificate. And trying to get a birth certificate for a 90-year-old who never had one, it's really almost impossible.
Well, I hate to and use so my anecdotal, you know, stories as sort of the norm. But when my grandmother was still alive, my grandmother was, you know, at the time 95, and we needed to get her ID because rules and stuff had changed and I needed to get her ID for health insurance purposes and bank purposes. She needed an ID. And I remember going to New York DMV. I did have a copy of her birth certificate, although it was like the day was off by a day, like all of the stuff. And they were like, okay, but her last name is X. Like, when, how did that, I was like, oh, she was married before, the person is now like deceased, like long time. Well, we need that marriage certificate. Sir, that was from like 1952. Like, I don't
gotta have it.
And they were like, well, you're gonna have to contact the, I was like, the North Carolina, like what? I was like, she's sitting in front of you. I was like, here's her birth certificate that's all tattered up from 1926. Here is the thing, like, sir. And he's like, sorry, she needs 8 points or whatever, like the thing was or whatever. And I'm like, she gets Social Security. Like, she's known. Like, look at the thing. Yep. And they,
she's here. So clearly she was born. I'm
like, no, physically here, you can see that she's 96. Here is the 1926 birth certificate that I can barely, like, please don't touch it. Only use it in the thing. She gets Social Security. Yep. Here is her Social Security card and check. Like, sir. And he is like, yeah, no.
No, we had a client, a gentleman in his 90s who was born in an incredibly small town in Texas, never got a birth certificate. And so we were trying to get one for him, and they want his hospital records. We're like, well, he wasn't born in a hospital. And they're like, well, we can have an affidavit from the preacher who baptized him. Well, this man is in his 90s, so that preacher is either a vampire or he's been long dead. And they were like, can you pull school records? Well, the one house school room was torn down, right? Like, that thing exists, but he's here. So clearly he was born. Like,
the fact that, you know, because some of the things we say to people, right, when people are like, oh, I'm not going to do this because, you know, the government be tracking you. I'm like, the government already know you exist, right? Like, there are so many other things and other systems you interact with. And, you know, like, for instance, Social Security. I feel like if you are receiving a Social Security check, there should be no way that you are prohibited from being validated to receive an ID.
Well, and here's the this is what, you know, COVID really showed people, because everybody got a stimulus check. I know a lot of people who don't have IDs who got stimulus checks because they couldn't cash those checks, right? Everybody got a stimulus check. The government didn't need you to fill out a form. The government didn't need you to tell you how many kids you had or anything else. They didn't need your address. They need a shred of your DNA.
They were sending out the check.
But those checks arrived. Those checks arrived. So if you could do that, first of all, you don't need us to file your taxes because you already know. And second, every single person is in the system. They should. And this is the thing, is we know, and this is part of our, you know, we're trying to get this bill passed to create free IDs, optional free IDs for everyone in the country. And we're like, all of the information is in the system. So we're not even asking the government to create any brand new system to spin. You have all of our information. Everybody here, every teenager in Kazakhstan has all of our credit card numbers and blood types. Like, you know where we are and who we are. You sent us stimulus checks with no input from us. But now look at me and tell me, you can't give this man an ID without his 400-year-old preacher signing an affidavit that he was born, but you sent him a check?
It was very, yeah. It's giving, you know, you don't want people to succeed, which, you know, one of the chapters in your book is like, no one has ever pulled themselves up by their bootstraps situation, right? Yeah. So it's like, yeah, no, you know this information. Same thing with taxes, right? Now, I am hesitant about sort of a nationwide database of like for identification purposes. And although our information exists in different systems throughout the federal government, and then this is where states' rights comes in, right? Because that's where you were talking about, states have the right to determine how to give people identification and what things they need.
Yeah, but what Real ID proved, right, is that the federal government can interfere with that too. Because the federal government told every single state, these are going to be the new federal requirements for IDs, and you have to do it. And every state had to say yes. And they complained and they pushed it up. But, like, it's the federal government, right? And with our bill, the IDs would be managed through the Social Security Administration, which is a national database of all of our information. It already exists. So we're not creating a new agency or a new office or a new anything. We're just like, hey, you know this agency that already has all of our information and already takes money from us out of every paycheck? Why don't we just run the IDs through them? Because it already exists, right? Like, that's the thing. I think people think states' rights is a thing, and it's really not, right? People think that privacy exists and it doesn't. And again, this is the thing that I thought that was really helpful about the stimulus checks, is it just proved the government has all of your information. They know where you are. They know everything. So any illusion that you had that there was something about you the government didn't know, it's not true. And so why don't we use that power for good? why don't we say, okay, since you already have all of our information, stop preventing people from getting the things that they need to live a healthy and successful life because you're pretending that you need proof of their identity when you know they exist. You know everything about them. You know, it's the same thing like the census. We still run it every 10 years by going door to door because it's in the Constitution, but it's completely unnecessary. The government doesn't need a survey to tell us anything about you. They already know. Right? Like there are easier ways. We just want to amend the Constitution. So we keep doing it through this backwards way that prevents poor and brown people from being counted, right? And undocumented people and all these other people, but they know. And I think that if we were willing to change our perspective from a fear-based perspective of, oh my God, we don't want the government interfering, to be like, we live in a government state, so let's use that like every other country, like Germans, who do not understand how it's possible that the government doesn't just provide people with everything they need, right? Yeah.
Well, in your book, we are talking to Kat Calvin, who is the author of American Identity in Crisis, Notes from an accidental activist. One of the things I want to shift to is talking about your view of activism in general, right? Mm-hmm. And starting with social media, which plays a huge role in activism today. Yes. And so I want to know your thoughts, positive or negative, as we are collectively in this movement for social change. What, you know, how does social media impact the work that we do from your perspective?
I love it. I'm moving, so I don't have any of my walls, but I have a framed tweet that is the first tweet that I ever sent out saying, hey, I think I'm going to start an organization to help people get IDs. Does anyone want to help? And like, I got all these calls, I got all these volunteers, some people who are still on my team to this day. Like, so, you know, social media is how we first raised funds. It's how we first met reporters and foundations. And, you know, right now, I think we're seeing the power of TikTok. Since Twitter is dead and there's nothing left for us. But, you know, I think it's been amazing seeing on TikTok and seeing footage and stories of people from the multiple genocides that are happening around the world and seeing all of these young people be able to be educated in a way that wasn't possible when we were kids because we were still depending on the news that wasn't even really 24-hour news yet. But now I can look on my phone and see somebody talking from Sudan or the Congo or Gaza about what's happening to them. And I'm, you know, cutting through any of the propaganda or the media or the government. And it's incredible. And you can see how much it's terrifying the powers in charge because we're not hearing it filtered at all. And you're seeing people learn how to take action, learn who, you know, to support and who to boycott and who to donate to. And being able, you know, I've seen incredible TikTok saying like, hey, here's this organization and, you know, here's why you should donate to them and showing exactly where their money goes or others that don't. I think that there is so much power in social media and that, you know, for us personally with our organization, we wouldn't exist without it. It was just, you know, particularly when you're trying to start a national or international movement, it is, you know, has been a really powerful way to connect. I'll plug a friend's book. Kari Williams has a book that came out of the month after mine called Microactivism. And her book is all the things that I preach, but in a much more beautiful and more eloquent way, and really talking about how people can get involved in very small ways. You know, people always say like, how do I get involved? What do I do? There's so much broken. And I'm always like, look, everything's broken in America. Choose one thing. You know, you can't fix everything. Choose one thing and choose a small way and get started like that. And her book really illustrates that in a really powerful way. And I think that social media allows people to do that, to really sort of dive deep into a subject and learn how to get involved while also keeping abreast to, you know, many of the other issues. I think it's a really powerful tool.
So there is a reason, I assume, that majority of the conversation is talking about helping people get ID for the majority aspects of their life, from accessing service to a job to healthcare. And while there is a conversation, and I remember people talking to you, and it was always focused on helping people get ID to vote. And I was like, I think she's helping people get ID to like live, right? Like from that standpoint. So not to say that voting is a, you know, a footprint or, you know, asterisk, but it then helps to do that. You know, one of the things I wanted to highlight in one of your takeaways is that people who do not have ID are generally not on campaign target lists, which usually include only people who have voted recently. And I've talked a bit about the difference of infrequent voters, prime voters is what campaigns and candidates, you know, even myself as a strategist for other campaigns and candidates, you know, we don't have unlimited time and money. And so we have to target based upon who is likely to turn out. It is harder to include infrequent voter or folks that you don't believe will even be paying attention or engaged because I don't know if I can count on them to, you know, to come out. Sometimes campaigns are counting on a larger percentage of that. And so they have to do more work. They have to do more touch. But do you view, I'm assuming that you do, so, but I don't want to put words in your mouth, if like the voting piece is a value add, but not sort of the sole reason.
For yeah. getting IDs? I mean, I think that they go hand in hand, you know? So when we first started, I was fully focused on voter ID because I didn't realize what a big issue this whole ID thing was. And we were going around talking to people and saying, hey, do you want us to help you get a, you know, an ID so you can vote? And every single person looked at us and said, I need a job. I don't know where I'm sleeping tonight. I don't know how I'm feeding my children. Can you get me an ID for that? And, you know, I realized it almost immediately, like, oh my God, wait, what's going on here? There's a really big problem here. But the other thing that happened is you cannot think about taking civic action or taking your place in a democracy if you don't know where you're sleeping at night or how you're feeding your children. And, you know, one of the things that people say most frequently to us, and actually the woman from Florida who we just helped get a birth certificate said the same thing. They say, I'm a person again. You cannot think about voting if you don't think you're a person, right? And you're not a person if you don't have identification. And so once we help people get the ID that they need to be able to build a life, then when we say, hey, can we talk to you about voting? They're totally ready. They're like, yeah, absolutely. Now I want to vote because now I can get a job and find a place to sleep, right? But we can't continue to talk to people about the thing that matters to us, right? Voting, because it affects us, without helping to address their needs, which incidentally do affect us in a larger way. But, you know, I think that we see these things as separate. And that, right, that's the problem we're going to have in next year's election, is we have a country full of people who are, you know, broke, you know, who are feeling hopeless, who can barely afford groceries, et cetera. And yet we're going to be asking them to vote. And that's a difficult thing. Really, why should we vote for you? We voted for you before and now eggs are $25, right? And so, like, I think that we see this everywhere we look where we think that life and voting are separate and they're not. They're, you know, and so when I think about getting folks IDs, I think about it from a, like, I know it's a life or death situation because we've seen people die because they haven't had IDs. I know how important it is because they need housing and et cetera. But I also know if there is a chance that they are going to be involved in their democracy, whether they live in a voter ID state or not, they are going to need to know that they are going to be safe and cared for before they can even begin to think about something like voting.
So you've mentioned a lot the legislation that sits in Congress now. It's the IDs for an Inclusive Democracy Act, which is sponsored by Sean Casten of Illinois and Cori Bush of Missouri. Sign some homework. I know you love doing that.
I do. So you can go to ID4ID.org and you can read all about the bill. Essentially, what it would do would be to establish a free and optional ID for all Americans over 14, actually. So well over the 26 million adults who need one. The goal is to make it accessible, to take it out of the DMV, to make it an ID that everybody can get. And so you can go to ID4ID.org and you can not only see the bill, but also, crucially, there's a section where you can get scripts and texts so you can email or call or text your member of Congress and ask them to support the bill. We've got a great bill in the House. We will be working next year on getting a bill in the Senate. And, you know, for a while there, we didn't have a speaker and we were like, oh, well, but now Congress is somewhat operating, but we're working on passing that bill. We're also working on legislation across different states and working with local government so that we're trying to change policy in a lot of different venues while we are working on the congressional bill. So please, definitely go there. You can also, follow us on social media at Spread the Vote US, at Project ID. I'm AF, I think. It's on our websites. And keep in touch and stay tuned. But also, I mean, obviously, I'm going to plug, buy the book, read the book, buy it for somebody else. It's fun. It's very short. I kept it short so that it's an easy weekend read. And, you know, my hope is that you'll walk away with some takeaways, maybe with some stories that really impacted you, and you'll be willing to share them with others.
The author is Kat Calvin, and the book is American Identity Crisis, Notes from an Accidental Activist. Kat, thank you so much for coming to the front of the class again. Thank you so much for taking time, and we look forward to seeing you in East Street.
Thank you. It's always so great to be here.
So if you've been inspired by today's conversation or the work Kat Calvin is doing and Spread the Vote and Project ID, and you want to get involved, particularly if you are in those states that require identification in order to vote, you can get involved. You can visit the website for the campaign that is organizing around the bill in Congress. It's id4id.org. So that's id4id.org. You can follow them on social media. And of course, don't forget to get a copy of Kat's book. I'm telling you, it's a good weekend read. I do wish, some folks would, particularly when it comes to civic engagement or civic participation type things, a good weekend read and making sure there's some like bullet points at the end and some homework. You know, it's a good format because people don't feel like, they've taken out a textbook, if you will. It's not like the team of rivals or something like that, right? So it's a good book to pick up. You can even do it digitally and make sure that you are active and engaged. And, you may be able to look at your community and see how many people need that help and support. And that might be something that your sorority, your fraternity, your nonprofit organization or someone might take on in helping to get people the identification that they need. So I want to thank you for making it to class this morning. I'm your host, L. Joy Williams. And I'll be back next week with more Sunday Civics, the show where we engage, educate, and encourage you to take civic action. Class dismissed.